Now let us turn to the prophecy of Isaiah, and we read from chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Above him, above it, stood the seraphim. Each one had six wings. With twain he covered his face, and with twain he covered his feet, and with twain he did fly. And one cried unto another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the posts, or the foundations of the door, the thresholds, were moved at the voice of him that cried. And the house was filled with smoke. Then said I, Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Then flew one of the seraphim unto me, having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with the tongs from off the altar. And he laid it upon my mouth, and said, Lo, this has touched thy lips, and thine iniquity is taken away, and thy sin purged. Also I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Then said I, Here am I, send me. And he said, Go and tell this people, Hear ye indeed, but understand not, and see ye indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert and be healed. Then said I, Lord, how long? And he answered, Until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate. And the Lord, that is, the Lord Jehovah, have removed men far away, and there be a great forsaking in the midst of the land. But yet it shall be a tenth, and it shall return, and shall be eaten as a teal tree, and as an oak whose substance is in them when they cast their leaves. So the holy seed shall be the substance or the stalk thereof. Now I'm sure that it will please the Lord in his grace to bless the reading of his word. Now we have come to another wonderful account of a man's experience with God. I list this as one of the most outstanding and certainly one of the most precious and ultimately one of the most practical of all that is before me in the ministry. It's a very familiar chapter. We're all very much acquainted with it, are we not? And most of it, I'm sure, we could repeat without any difficulty. But we're just going to look at it from the standpoint of the subjects, a man's encounter with God. I don't think that this was what we might term Isaiah's call to service. I think that this is something distinct from his actual call to the prophecy and the prophetic office. I think when we read the closing verses of the chapter, about which we often hear so little, because the chapter is read often, but these latter parts are usually left untouched. I think that the commission that these verses entail demanded that Isaiah undergo, shall I say, the demands, the distinctiveness of this encounter with God. When God has something special for His people, for His servants, I would feel an experience of this nature is not only necessary, but very valuable. The demand that it made upon Isaiah is registered by his question, which we will come to ultimately, the Lord giving us the help our brother prayed for. Now, let us get the setting. How does this encounter come about? Each night or each time we have looked at a chapter of this nature already, we have discovered there is a background. There are circumstances, and they are conducive, and the background is conducive to the experience. What I'm going to say, or how I'm going to entitle it, is this. I would look on verse 1 as indicating that it was a time of visitation. A time of visitation. There can be no doubt about it, but the death of Uzziah was very, very important. It had cast its own meaningful message right across the nation. And of course, very clearly, directly to the heart of the prophet. What significance can we gather from his death? A very solemn significance. A man, and we would have to believe he belonged to God, died under an unlifted stroke of governmental chastisement. That's solemn, isn't it? An unlifted stroke. From the moment that stroke fell upon him, he never knew relief from it until he died. I tell you, brethren, that is severely significant. Nothing would frighten me more than to think this soul of mine could undergo, could come into such an experience with God. It could. Many have had it. Many are undergoing the same at this moment of time. And that is very solemn, isn't it? You can understand the searching nature of this event. In the nation, the highest man in the land has died a leper. All the implications are far-reaching. The message is penetrating. And listen, ought it not awaken us to the tremendous solemnity of sin in divine things? That's what it was a result of, was it not? We all know what Isaiah did. We all know what he has said to do. He moved out of his God-appointed sphere. He misappropriated a role that was not accredited to him of God. You apply this whatever way you will. And in doing so, he invoked divine displeasure and received the stroke of which I have spoken. Now you understand that, don't you? What did he do? As a king, he sought to be a priest. And in the sanctuary of God, he is said to offer incense. In a sphere, he was not permitted to function. Now, I haven't time to apply that as I would, but I want you to apply it tonight. In whatever way you feel the Spirit of God would have you do. And I'm sure it will have its own effect. And it would cause me to pray, Lord, preserve me from such presumption. To move outside my God-appointed sphere. And to do something that would incur divine displeasure to this extent that I could be under the governmental hand of God until my very last breath. I don't think there's anything more shaking. I don't think there is anything more solemn than that. And that's what's here. Now, we understand that it must have had its own effect upon Isaiah. As he thought of this king on a throne, disposed, diseased, and now dead. What is there? When the highest man on the earth, as far as the kingdom was concerned, succumbs to such failure, and undergo such discipline, what hope have I? Now, that is its own way of working, and one of the many ways it works. But if you apply that, be careful, and do not take it to the extreme of being inopportune. What I mean by that is this. Don't you use this as an argument against you doing something for God. That's the point. If a man of such power, if a man of such prominence can fall, what then of me? A good question. But beloved, don't look at it in a fatalistic manner. Many do. And absolve themselves from whatever God has for them. You see, it was a time of visitation. But then it was also a time of vision. For it says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. Now, I was going to say the apostle have to be careful here. The prophet uses that word saw in chapter 1, and he uses it in chapter 2, if I remember correctly. But it's not the same word as he uses here. Is a different word. Because this was a vision transmitted to him of the Lord sitting upon a throne high and lifted up. I would tonight that we had time to elaborate on those words, but let us do it a little. Sitting undisturbed. High. Undefiled. Above it all. And lifted up. In that wonderful measure. Thank God for the glory of our God. He's above the circumstances. He's beyond the taint, the touch of iniquity. The defilement that this man's sin has brought is tremendous. Anyone that touched him was defiled. Anything that he touched was defiled. But here is a realm into which the prophet is brought. And he sees this blessed one. Undisturbed. Undefiled. And in that sense, his power undiminished. You know, I think it's good for us to see that. Let us get our eyes off men. And men that have fallen. And men that could fall. Any of us. All of us. Others included. And the Lord enable us tonight, fellow saints, just to rise above it all and have this communicated to our hearts. In spite of what Uzziah did, in spite of his high place of power, here is one that is undisturbed, undefiled, and undiminished in power. Sitting upon a throne. I think that's an excellent, I think that's a glorious presentation under the circumstances of the opening phrase. Time of vision. You know, he tells us here, I saw the Lord. Now, if you have a New Breed Bible, you will notice that that's a distinct title. Adonai. The plural of Adon. And that, of course, indicates that he is the proprietor. That indicates that he is the preeminent one. It's a word that is used to describe Abraham, for example, in Genesis 14 as head of the house. Genesis 24 rather, as head of the household. It's the same word as David's wife uses of him in 1 Kings chapter 1. But when it's applied to deity, and in the plural form here, then of course it deals with the absolute preeminence of the Lord. That is, he is the proprietor of everything, all under his absolute control. We have to go down to verse 3 and see another title. Lord of hosts. Lord of Sabaoth. That's tremendous, isn't it? Do you know where that was first used? Was it used first of all in 1 Samuel? In connection with Hannah? You take time to notice how many times it occurs. For example, in Zechariah, in Haggai, in Malachi, in Jeremiah. Whatever. And of course, what does it indicate? That he has all the resources, all the power under his absolute control. Lord of hosts. And you see, it adds, does it not, to the richness, to the glory of the person that he's looking upon at this moment of time. And look at how it occurs in the chapter. Notice too the many times the word Adon occurs. And then further down you'll see at the end of the chapter, verse 12, Jehovah, the covenant-keeping God. the Lord of promise, the Lord who fulfills every promise. And so you see, the chapter in itself, with the divine titles that are used, unfold to us the greatness and the glory of the person he sees at this time. When I think of the word throne, I would like to dwell on that just for a moment and try and help you to do some work. Isaiah uses the word throne. Jeremiah uses the word throne. Ezekiel uses the word throne. And so does Daniel. Now, that's a useful work for you to do. Start reading and just get the words and the term in their context in those four mighty prophets. And notice that they link the message of each prophet in connection with what is before us now. When I think of the throne, for example, in Daniel, it's there in the context of Israel having lost its sovereignty. It's no longer head of the nations. That vision committed to Nebuchadnezzar and the appropriate interpretation by Daniel begins like this. Daniel addressing Nebuchadnezzar, thou art that head of gold. No longer in Israel. They have lost their sovereignty. When we come to Ezekiel, you know the story of the reluctant yet gradual departure of the glory. Lost the glory. It has receded from the temple. And it is returned to heaven. Visible, gradual, but nonetheless real. What a pity. What a sadness. Jeremiah, at that point, it wasn't so. But Jeremiah is telling them, and it's the reason why they reject his ministry. He says, you're going to lose your territory for 70 years. Jeremiah 25. Jeremiah 17 is one of the lovely verses that carries the reference to the throne. And they have lost their territory. What is it in this chapter? What is it in this? I'm going to say an epistle. I got used to saying that. And you know, the language of Isaiah is so New Testament-like. You figure just in an epistle. You'll forgive me. But in this prophecy, the message in Isaiah or from Isaiah is this to the nation. You have lost your purity. Purity. Now I want you to apply that. I must apply it to myself. We can do it individually. We can do it corporately. We can do it as individual believers. Or we can do it as a company or companies of God's people. What have we lost? What are we losing in terms of these great passages? You think of assemblies that have closed since I first came in 1966 in this land. Think of it. You think, dear saints of God, of the tragic loss of territory in every land. Isn't it sad? Instead of extinction. In many places we're facing extinction. That's sad. Something wrong. And you think of our sanctity, our purity. You think, beloved, of the lack of this in our lives. And I haven't time to apply the rest, but I think that you understand what I mean. Now, this is the emphasis in this chapter. Everything is marked by purity. This king died having lost that very thing. In the impurity and all that it meant ceremonially of leprosy. And you can understand now, when we come to it, why the prophet says what he says. But let us see now. First of all, in this vision he saw the glory of heaven sovereign. I saw the Lord. And then the next thing, he heard the voice of heaven's seraphim. Why seraphim? Well, I think you understand that these are the principalities and powers that are associated with holiness. Not cherubim here, not cherubim. Cherubim are associated with divine righteousness. But here are the elements, the attributes, the essentials of divine holiness, my brethren. And that's so necessary to find that here. And so is this, he hears the voice. Heaven's seraphim. What are they crying? We are told. They cried unto another and said, one cried unto another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. I think we have heard that often enough to understand what it means. Why must the word Adon be plural? Why must there be the thrice holy cry? Well, in this passage here, it's Jehovah, Isaiah 6. In John chapter 12, it's the Lord Jesus. These things, says John, spake Isaiah when he beheld his glory. His glory. And when we come to Acts chapter 28, where this chapter is quoted by the apostle, it's the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit. Marvelous, isn't it? How comprehensive. How confirming. How essential. And can't you understand what it's doing? Can't you understand, saint of God, what it means? That when you come into the presence of a holy, a thrice holy God, you're in the presence of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Such a concentration of holiness. It's beyond our language to describe. Do we realize it? Are we enjoying it? Are we expressing it? Are we the living expression of our profession that we speak daily to a thrice holy God? Isn't that what's here? Isn't that the impression that's been made on this man's heart? Surely, beloved, come on now, face it. Look at the impact. The foundations of the thresholds of the house were moved at the voice of him that cried. Anyone standing on those thresholds would have trembled. You know, beloved, I'm thinking of this very personally and pertinently. How do you feel when you cross the door of that hall? How do you feel? Does it mean anything to you? Do you come in as though you were coming into whatever? I think we have lost something of this. Oh, that we had a consciousness of such an encounter with our God. At the very foundation, the very threshold, would cause us to tremble at the voice of him that cried. And the house was filled with smoke. That, of course, indicates the cloud. This isn't the smoke of fire. This is the cloud of incense, of glory, rather. The cloud of glory. For we read in verse 1 that his train filled the temple, his skirts. Why do I emphasize that? Because the one that Isaiah sees is a priest-king and a king-priest. That's what Uzziah tried to be and underwent divine judgment. But his skirts. Where did you get that word again? Well, where did you get it first? Exodus 28. The garments of the high priest. He's a priestly king. You understand that. Zechariah 6 confirms it. And you see, it doesn't matter, beloved. You want to get this young man, young woman, get this into your soul. It doesn't matter how disobedient, how destructive a man or men may be of truth. Remember, it's preserved and viable in him. Remember that. We're not governed by what men make, mistakes or otherwise. We're governed by the positive revelation of God. Then said I, "That good." Isn't that something we have noticed? Genesis 15, and Abram said, Judges 6, and Gideon said, and last night, how many times, and Moses said, here's the same thing, then said I. Not good. I don't know. I'm looking at you and you're looking at me down there. And I don't know if you have had anything of this nature. I'd love to think you have. I'm sure you must have. Where you can have intercourse with God and commune with him personally, privately, and of course, purposefully. Then said I, bound to affect him. Bound to affect him. No person has ever come through such an experience as this and not be affected. Then after such an impact has been made on her soul, by the vision of heaven's sovereign, by the voice of heaven's seraphim. Then said I never felt as good. No. Tono, friend. I'm one of the best prophets ever. Never. Friend, listen, there's no room for that in the heart of a man that knows his God. Then said I, woe is me, for I am undone. Because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. What's he saying? He's saying, Lord, this is the year that leper died, but there are many still living. I'm one of them. I feel as loathsome as that leprous king. I'm a man of unclean lips. Well, you understand that, don't you, with Leviticus, the man putting his hand over his mouth, crying, unclean, unclean. That's what this man's doing. He's taking the place of a leper. I tell you, brethren, allow me to say it lovingly to men that I've loved for many years. You understand my heart. There's no room for pride in this passage. None at all. So mercy, we're here. Mercy, we're standing before you. Allow me to embrace you tonight in love. It's a mercy you're with us. Is it not? What has brought this about? Mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. The Lord of hosts. There it is again. Mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Could you equal that? Have you seen him today? How long is it since you looked at him? Isn't the way into his presence the same? Has there not been a transformation of the way into the presence of God even from these days? My word. Then flew one of the seraphim, having a live coal from in his hand, which he had taken with the tongs from off the altar. Not lovely. You see, we're at Calvary. Eh? Remember Calvary in Genesis 15? Remember Calvary in Judges 6? The fire and the rock. Remember Calvary last night in Exodus 3? The bush burned with fire and not consumed. Here's the altar with its live coal in the tongs from off the burning altar. Calvary. This is the brazen altar, brethren. This is the altar of sacrifice. This is one of those coals that lifted up by the fire of God, the sacrifice that filled the nostrils of God with divine pleasure in the morning and in the evening sacrifice. And the freshness and the fullness of the sacrifice is now being applied to the very lips and heart and soul and being of the man in the presence of God, so repentant and so reduced. Oh, God, give us more of that. You see, brethren, what we really need is not only a vision of heaven's sovereign, and not only the voice of heaven's seraphim, but listen, brethren, we need more of the value of heaven's sacrifice. More and more. Applied. Not material for discussion in a by reading. Thank God for that. Not arguments in whatever form of discussion or ministry, whatever that may be, but a real, a personal, a deep application of the mighty work of Christ to our souls, being in and out. This was here then. And the implement, handling the attribute of divine holiness, will move toward us and affect the same cleansing. Still. How much we need that? Oh, how much we need it. Is not this the encounter we're after? Is not this the prayer exercise of our hearts? Is not this the longing of our souls that we knew something more of Him? That we knew something more experimentally of the work of Christ? We know the position has brought us into. We know our association with Him. But oh, it's a Romans 6 experience, isn't it? It's a Galatians 2:20 experience. It's the practical, it's the personal application that brings us into the good of the cleansing, and thus the holiness it promotes. He heard. He saw. He felt. And he hears the voice again. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying. It's not lovely. Oh, I thank God for that. Get the voice in Genesis 15. Get the voice in Judges 6. Get the voice in Exodus 3. Here's the voice of the Lord. Got it? And as you understand this, I'm sure, beloved, as he feels the power of heaven's sacrifice, and it awakens and brings him into this consciousness now of this voice. It was a time of visitation, number one. It was a time of vision, number two. But it was also a time of vocation. Vocation. I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? Now he knows the privilege of heaven's service. Heaven's sovereign. Heaven's seraphim, heaven's sacrifice, heaven's service. Now listen, I know that you're exercised to do something for God. Cherish that exercise. Develop it as much as you possibly can. But don't forget this. And this chapter is full of it. You be deeply concerned, first of all, about what God is wanting to do in you. You got that? Not so much what God is interested in doing through you, but what He is interested in doing in you. That's the point of this encounter. And if that can be wrought in your soul, young man, young woman, older friend, then of course it will be a tremendous stand to you in days to come. For example, look at these seraphim. With twain they covered their feet. With twain they covered their face. And with twain they did fly. Six wings. Two thirds veiled in worship. One third in service. That's the proportion. Even in the seraphim. In other words, they are conscious of what God is doing in them. And then what they would do for Him. And you look at the work that God is doing in this man before he hears the voice, "Who will go for us?" Because he has submitted, because he has yielded, because he has come to that point of absoluteness before God, then he can hear the voice, "Who will go for us?" "Then," said I, second time, "Here am I, send me." I tell you, brethren, I want us everyone just to be renewed in our souls tonight and come to that point as never before. What the Lord has for you to do, He knows best. You might feel you're past it. You might feel you're too inexperienced. I don't want you to be occupied with those arguments. Just let us come within the compass of this engagement. And before Him, with all that we have simply covered tonight, re-experienced in your heart, just stand before Him and yield unreservedly. "Here am I, send me." Now, I haven't time to go into the message, but the construction of the message is most interesting. I want you to notice verse 10. Heart, ears, eyes. You see that? Make the heart, make their ears, and shut their eyes. Now, look at the next part. Eyes, ears, heart. See that? That's the construction. Heart, both sides. Ears, both sides. But the focus, eyes. The way in and the way out, eyes. Now, I what? I saw the Lord. Mine eyes have seen the King. I don't need to emphasize the importance of the eye in this chapter. Now in this message becomes the focal point of the judgment. Could anything be more updated? When you think of the eyes of the world tonight and how they're being corrupted in such a concentrated form until they're blinded. Terrible, isn't it? Now, of course, this is Israel. And as you know, this is the most quoted verse of the Old Testament in the New Testament. Check that out and tell me I'm wrong tomorrow night, won't you? But it is. And it was so overwhelming to carry such a commission. Even though he was committed. Then said I, how long? Not good. The third time, then said I. You notice what he said the first time, then said I, verse 5, woe is me, for I'm undone. That's in relation to the first part of the vision. Then said I in verse number 8, here am I, sent me. That's in relation to the second part of the vision, the cleansing of the sacrifice. Now he has become the receptacle of the message. And it's so overwhelming. He says, Lord, how long? I could answer that for you, but it's time to home, isn't it? All I'll do is this. I'm going to take out the word until. See? And then I'm going to quote three verses and you listen, and then I'll say amen. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate, and ye shall not see me again until ye shall say, until. Ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. That says as long as it's going to be. As far as the house is concerned, until. Now you know that that is Luke's Gospel 13. Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until. You know what that means? Until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Until. That's the city. The house. Luke 13. The city. Luke 22. Now, darkness in part has happened unto Israel, or blindness has happened unto Israel, until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. No wonder this man asked how long. That's the city, Luke 22. That's the temple, Luke 13. And that's the people, Romans 11. What's the message? Brother, it doesn't matter how burdening the commission. It doesn't matter how burdening the responsibility. You yield, and He will give grace to perform.